By the time I started my research, around 10,000 people had already left the city in search of a better life. I wanted to find someone who had stayed in the area and could tell me about their experience with the mill's downfall. I found a story written in 2006 by an Associated Press reporter, Vicki Smith. She wrote about the city's decline through the lens of the tragic death of a Wheaton Steel employee. His name was Larry Tice, and his surviving wife, Mary, lives in New Cumberland, West Virginia, about 6 miles north of Wheaton. I figured if there was anyone who could summarize the pain felt in the region, it was Mary. So I took a drive up Route 2 to visit her.
Hey.
Did you have any trouble finding it?
Well, I passed it, and then I checked my notes again, and I was like, okay, red brick house, green mailbox. And then I was like, okay, I think I just saw that.
I just put my dog in the bedroom.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. She showed me into her house, and I was blanketed with the smell of candles. Peppermint, apple, cinnamon, one burning in every room.
If you don't mind, I'm going to let her out, let her sniff you, and then she'll shut up. And so then I'll put her back in the room. Be patient, settle down. Settle, settle, settle.
Her kitchen was filled with Amish furniture that her and Larry had bought over the years. A giant hooser made of solid oak with a 48-inch pull-out table. The spice cabinet and the table we eventually sat at were all handmade to their specifications.
And it was funny because he used to buy me jewelry, and then I was like, don't buy me jewelry anymore, buy me furniture.
Mary was happy to tell me more about her and Larry's love. They met when she was only 12 years old. She was at a friend's house getting ready for a church cantata, and Larry happened to be there with his buddy, who knew her friend's father. As Mary came down the stairs dressed in a lavender gown, Larry was standing in the room below.
And when I started to walk by, he says, what's your name? And I told him, I said, my name's Mary Hall, because Hall was my maiden name. And I said, you know, why do you want to know my name? And he says, well, I'm Larry Tice. And I said, okay. And he says, remember my name. I said, why should I remember your name? He says, I'll be the person who marries you someday. And he did, 6 years later.
That was 1980 when they married, a year after she graduated from high school. Larry had been working at Wheaton Steel since 1973, and they eventually bought a house together. Mary worked several clerical jobs in the healthcare industry, even though she didn't have to. Larry's income at the mill was enough, but they liked to treat each other, and Mary's second income helped. She showed me some of the things he had gifted her. Hundreds of cherished teddies, horses, angel figurines, a kabuki doll, a music box. Her curio cabinet was filled with trinkets and gifts from Larry. But there was something else Mary wanted to show me, something even more special. We walked into her bedroom, and she pulled out what seemed to be a simple blue post-it note from her jewelry box. It turned out to be so much more than that. In 2004, her mother passed away. Knowing Mary would be hurting during Christmas time that year, Larry gifted her a pair of golden hoop earrings as a final gift from her mother. Even though he wasn't a great writer, he included a note, which she read aloud to me.
It says, "The last gift a mother's love for her daughter lasted a lifetime. It shines like a brilliant diamond in sunlight, bright shiny like her smiling face, full of love and pride because her baby is now full grown woman now, herself full of love too, passed on now. Circle is complete love given forever like this gift." And it's in my jewelry box. I have kept it in my jewelry box since then.
She set the note aside and searched for the earrings.
I might have them in one of my other. There they are. But they're...
Wow.
Yeah. So, but that was the last gift that he said my mom gave me. So, but, yeah. And that was one of the things that was him, you know. Did that because he knew I was missing my mom.
For a while, Mary and Larry were able to live out their American dream. They owned a house, had a steady income, and enjoyed life together. But this wouldn't last forever.
So it just was the two of us, you know, just work hard and, you know, plan for retirement, and which never came.
Larry walked straight out of high school into the heart of the mill, the basic oxygen plant. It was a scary-looking building. At 20 stories high, the 250,000-square-foot structure seemed to take up most of downtown, like an idling beast.
So as a kid, you know, everybody used to say, you know, that place is evil, you know, because it was the devil's house because of the molten steel in the bottom that you could see when you go by with the ingots and that, and then the horns at the top.
Larry was a crew chief in that molten hell, known more often as the pit. Needle-like lances would drop down into furnaces full of scrap metal and molten iron and shoot out oxygen at 1,600 miles per hour. This would heat the metals up to 3,000 degrees, smelting them into 300 tons of steel in 25 minutes. The job wasn't for the faint of heart, and Larry had not only himself to worry about, but his crew as well. Mary told me that when Larry was training new workers, he emphasized the undivided attention needed for the job. Otherwise, you could pay the ultimate price.
He says, if I tell you to move, don't say huh, because you'll be burnt alive.
A total of 120 men died while working at Weirton Steel. The dangers made it all the more important for steelworkers to have a deep trust in one another.
They were all very close-knit, and each crew, they knew how to depend on each other. They knew what each one was capable of doing and doing for them, for each of them. And that solidified a bond that I can't even imagine. They would give their lives for each other. And I mean, Larry even said that. He says, if it comes down to, he said, me or one of my buddies, he says, it's me.
Larry would work in this flaming kingdom for 30 years, his whole life's dedication spent refining a dangerous but rewarding craft. Yet, these years of devotion in the pit would make it all the harder for Larry when Weirton Steel finally went under. Along with several other steel mills in the early 2000s, Weirton Steel filed for bankruptcy on May 19, 2003, after reporting around $700 million in losses over the previous 5 years. The mill would be bought and sold a few times, ultimately ending with its new name, ArcelorMittal Weirton. All the while, the 3,000 workers who remained at this time were left to worry about their future. Mary said it was a very tense time for everyone in Weirton.
The change and just the worry, you know, am I going to go to work tomorrow and have a job? Am I, you know, are they going to come in and say, hey, we're going to take this off of you now, you know, no health care, you know, we're going to take another 20% or we're going to do that. It was just the not knowing, I think, half the time.
And changes did come. With Weirton Steel filing for bankruptcy, they handed over their pension fund to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or PBGC, a government agency that takes over benefit payments for businesses whose pension funds are floundering or at risk. According to a PBGC press release, Weirton Steel Corporation's retirement plan, which covered about 9,200 workers and retirees, only had $530 million in assets to cover almost $1.35 billion in benefit liabilities. The PBGC executive director at the time, Steve Kandarian, was quoted saying that, I regret that the PBGC has been forced to take this course of action. Because Weirton Steel did not set aside enough money to pay for the pension promises made to its employees, some participants will not get all the benefits they earned, which is exactly what happened to Larry and his fellow steelworkers.
Per his calculations, he probably would have gotten clear around $3,000 a month. By the time that PBGC got a hold of it, he would have gotten less than $1,600 a month before taxes.
The PBGC method includes considering how long an employee has worked and how old the worker is at the time the pension take over. For example, if a man is 45 years old, because he is relatively young, he may see his owed pension reduced by a large magnitude. And on the other side of the equation, a man who is 65 might not see such a large reduction due to his age. The PBGC figures that a person like Larry, who was 48 at the time, could still continue working and build up a new pension under ArcelorMittal or another company. What it doesn't take into account, though, is the social and economic anxiety surrounding these situations.
He could see everything folding, I think, and, you know, because that's what he kept saying. He says, I've worked so hard for so long, gave this place my blood, sweat, and tears, and then somebody just sitting behind a desk says, nope, we're going to take half of it. And I mean, he's not the only one that said that. I mean, you know, you don't work that hard for that long in that type of a dangerous job for somebody to just, who's never walked through the mill, you know, they're nothing looking at a paper with numbers on it and say, yeah, we're going to make cuts here, we're going to make them here, and they don't realize the lives behind those numbers. It was like, how? How did we let this happen? How did other individuals have that many people's lives in their hands and just say, we don't care?
Wheat and Steel also cut off health care benefits for all of its retirees. He contemplated taking a buyout, but wasn't sure what he would do after that. It would be hard to find a job that offered as much as the mill did.
I mean, and that's what, and I think that was part of Larry's desperation too. It's like, what am I going to do? I have done nothing. I went straight from high school into this. What do I have to fall back on? What can I do if I take the buyout?
After declining the buyout and being laid off for several months, Larry returned to work in January of 2006. By then, the BOP had ceased operations as the new owners started downsizing the mill into a tin finishing plant, eliminating all parts of the steelmaking process except for the last steps. Larry was able to retain his employment, but he would no longer face the heat he thrived in for so long. He was transferred to the tin mill department where he started learning how to operate a side trimmer, a computer-operated machine that cuts down steel coils to specific widths. Rumor has it, though, Larry was being bullied by the guys who were training him.
Once they put him in with the computer and then the guys weren't training him properly and that, and, you know, well, you've got to get this. You've got 2 weeks to do this. And, you know, he'd come home and tell me, and I'm like, 2 weeks? Nobody's going to learn a new job in 2 weeks. And he says, well, if I don't learn the job, he said, they're going to move on to somebody else. I said, they can't. You're the oldest guy. He says, but the other guys, that they didn't want to keep him any longer to train the new people. So basically the higher-ups were saying, you got to train these old guys within a couple weeks, and then the younger guys are out of there. And then they weren't training them properly.
Mary had already noticed changes in Larry by Christmas time of 2005, and things were about to unravel even further. He was becoming more quiet, more closed off. He was on his long weekend and supposed to return to the tin mill on a Thursday. Mary pushed him to see a doctor.
He went to the doctor. I was at work, and he stopped in at my job. I said, how'd it go? I don't know. I said, what did he give you? I don't know. You know, and he's like, I don't know that stuff. So I told him, I said, okay. He said, well, I'm going to stop at the pharmacy and get it. And I'm like, okay. So when I got home, it was on the table Tuesday evening. And I looked at it, and I said, you know, but he says, yeah, take it. He said, in the mornings, he said, with food. And I'm like, okay.
That night, as they were watching TV, Larry randomly mentioned he wanted to get rid of some of his guns. Mary said, okay, do whatever you want. They're your guns. The next morning, Larry got up before her and had her breakfast and tea ready. She asked him what he planned to do that day. He said he wanted to get his guns cleaned and cataloged, and then decide what he wanted to keep and what he would sell.
So I got ready and got ready to leave, and we had a corner where our microwave was in the kitchen, and he was backed up against the microwave, and he says, come here, and he opened the robe up and just give me a big bear hug, and he says, I love you, and he says, I'll see you later, and I said, okay. I said, well, I'll call you later this morning. I said, find out what you want to do later.
Around 10:30 in the morning, Mary got a strange feeling and felt the need to call Larry.
He picked up the phone, and I could just hear something in his voice. And I said, what's going on? He says, nothing. And I said, what's going on? And he says, I'm so stupid. I'm so dumb. And I'm thinking, okay, he broke a dish. He stepped on the dog. He, whatever, you know, something goofy. And I said, okay, what did you do? And he says, oh, I'll show you when I get home. Or when you get home. And I said, tell me, I'm going to worry all day. No, I'll just show you when you get home. I said, okay. And I hung the phone up. And then that's when the girl that was where I worked at was sitting next to me. And I just got this sharp pain in my chest. I thought I was having a heart attack. And Carla looked at me and I said, 911. All I could just say was 911 because I thought I was having a heart attack. And it just started to subsiding. And I said, no, never mind. And I said, I picked the phone back up and tried to call, and there was no answer. And I kept calling and calling, and I thought, something's wrong.
Mary tried to have a neighbor check on him, but they were afraid of her two dogs, so they didn't go in the house. At this point, she knew she had to go home to check on Larry.
I pulled in the driveway, pulled in front of the house, and I tried the knob and the door was unlocked. And when I went to open the door up, I seen Thor's food was there, and both dogs greeted me at the door because the kitchen door was open. And I'm like, Larry wouldn't let them eat out here together. And the food bowl was still full, but there was poop. When I opened the door, there was poop in front of the door. And I'm like, my dogs do not poop in the house. And when I walked into the kitchen, the sink was like to my left, and that my breakfast dishes was soaking in there. And I'm like, Larry, I said, where are you, Larry? And I looked, and the light was on in the den where we had that's where his gun cabinet was in that. And there was stuff on the floor where he had taken it out of the bottom drawers and was, you know, getting stuff out of there. And our living room was straight through, and he was laying in front of the couch with his head toward the kitchen. And he laid like that sometimes if his back bothered him. And I said, hey, I said, are you sleeping? And the dogs followed me in to the room because I never put them back outside. And when I walked in, I looked down and his eyes were open and he was gone. And I could tell from his face, but he had shot himself, they said, in his heart. I didn't remember any of this for about 3.5 years.
Larry's medicine was still sitting on the table. He hadn't taken one dose yet.
The two dogs that knew what happened in that house are gone. I wish they could have talked back then. So, I mean, you know, between God and those two dogs and my husband, nobody knows what's happened. Larry was the type, he sheltered me a lot with different things. Didn't want me to worry. But I was a lot stronger than he ever thought I was.
Mary said there weren't any mental health programs for mill workers at the time. Only after the fact did people pay more attention. When she originally talked to Vicki Smith for the Associated Press article, she was apprehensive. But she figured if she told Larry's story, she might be able to help someone going through a similar situation.
And I found out later that there was a gentleman who was contemplating suicide and had was at home alone and went to pick up the paper to read before he did, had the gun on his lap, and read the article that Vicki had wrote and said, I couldn't leave my family like this, not in the pain that woman went through, and he called for help and got help.
Mary was right. Larry's story does resonate with others. When you take someone's identity away from them, built up through years of labor and commitment, it's hard to say how they'll react. Some recover, some don't. So it makes you wonder, just like Mary did, how did we let this happen? It was the same thing I was thinking as I watched the BOP falling. All things come to an end, of course, but some end much better than others.